I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. First comes love, then comes marriage, then for about 50% of us, it's divorce. Navigating these major events can bring out the best and worst in us. To help us examine the behavior boundaries during these times, we're joined today by the ethics professors. While some take the stance that all is fair in love and war, we'll learn what other philosophies apply in coming together and breaking apart. With us, a family law attorney who also is the soon-to-be ex-wife of one of the professors. Together, we look at why our principles seem to go out the window when passions run high. A conversation on the ethics involved with the creation and dissolution of emotional bonds on Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. When you marry, those in the new relationship make promises to each other. One common one is to love and to cherish from this day forward until death do us part. But we all know that something like 50% of all marriages these days don't survive. And that raises questions about the nature of the marriage vow itself. What kind of promise is that? And what are the morally appropriate grounds for breaking that marriage off? What happens when one person wants out and the other one doesn't? Today we'll talk about love, marriage, and divorce with the ethics professors and one very special guest. The ethics professors are Wayne Vaught, who is no longer the interim dean of the College of Arts and Sciences here at UMKC. He is the dean, and the announcement of his promotion was made just yesterday. And Wayne, congratulations, and so good to have you here again.
Well, thanks so much, Steve, and thanks for having me on the show again.
Clancy Martin is a chair of the Department of Philosophy and professor of philosophy at UMKC. He has authored, co-authored, and edited several books in philosophy, including Love, Lies, and Marriage. Clancy, good to have you.
Thanks for having
always.
Us, Steve.
And Rebecca Martin's also here. She's returned to a private law practice in family law. She's taught at UMKC for a number of years, and it's great to have her here. And I guess I should note that she and Clancy are in the process of going through a divorce. Rebecca, good morning. Nice to have you, too.
Good morning.
You would think that marriage vows are a special kind of promise, you know, one made before friends and family and for those people of faith, Clancy, for in front of God. But what does it say about the nature of that promise, given that this particular promise is broken as often as it is?
It's a fascinating question. I mean, certainly we don't want to say that statistics have anything to do with the moral significance of a promise, right? Because it's not just marriage promises that are broken all the time, but all sorts of promises that people make that are binding in one way or another.
But this is a big one.
But this is a big one, and that's why I think it's particularly interesting, and it's frequently seen, not just in conservative America, but also, I think, throughout Western civilization. And has been a kind of foundation for the moral structure of society. So we're talking about, in part, because it's the traditional institution, at least until recently, under which children are raised, which, again, we see as part of the moral fabric of our social organization. And the duties that that promise of marriage entails are duties greater than just the promise to be faithful and to be together for the rest of your life for that particular couple, because marriage is a social institution. So it has ramifications for the couple's friends, ramifications for the children if they have children, ramifications for their professional life, and maybe also depending upon their relationship with the church, it may have ramifications with their relationship with God. So, yeah, it's an incredibly interesting promise. Some people might think it's about the biggest promise you can make.
Well, you know, that raises a question, Rebecca. This idea, Clancy just pointed out, that people make lots of promises to each other. Does this one carry more weight? I mean, it's a promise like, you know, in some ways like many other promises, but again, it does tend to carry these greater ramifications. What do you think?
Well, as an attorney, I think that when I mean, marriages are a funny kind of promise, right? They're a fun, and divorces are a funny kind of litigation. They're not, you know, it's not like a normal contract dispute or something along those lines. But I do think that when those duties and obligations that the parties make to each other are violated or broken, that, you know, that you know, oftentimes divorce is the answer because one or the other person isn't getting what they were promised from mm-hmm. the original mm-hmm. marriage, right?
So it is a different kind of promise. It's a weightier promise.
It is. I mean, it's not just like a business transaction, right?
But it is in some ways, too.
It is, although, you know, one interesting thing in family law is that there have been all of these recent developments because, you know, to treat a divorce like any other kind of litigation, I think, unless it's absolutely necessary, is a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you have two people who have gone from being, you know, partners to being enemies overnight if it's treated like regular litigation. And mm-hmm. so there have been these new developments with things like collaborative divorce.
Make it less so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, like with collaborative divorce, for example, the parties try to come to settle all the terms mm-hmm. in a friendly way. And then they file and are able to get the dissolution without arguing and without, you know, doing all of the normal discovery processes necessarily mm-hmm. that one would do in a typical litigation
yeah.
situation.
Well, I should just point out that the two of you are here today. You're going through a divorce right now, but it's amicable, Clancy. It obviously seems like it from my vantage point. I'm hoping it is for the next 45 minutes here. tell us about it. And you're working on a book together, I think? Or
right. Yes, we've worked on a couple of books together over the past few years, and a book may emerge out of this process too. It would be a fun one to write together. It's been on the whole, it's been a very amicable divorce. Like any other couple, we will have our rocky conversations, and then we will have our easy conversations. But one technique that we've learned that I would recommend to other divorced couples out there is when you can see that your conversation is going in the wrong direction and it's going to be counterproductive, one or the other of you could just stop the conversation and say, hey, do you feel like this conversation is productive? And the other person will generally say, no, I'm getting angrier and angrier. And then you say, okay, well, let's just change the subject and talk about something else. You know,
right.
Let's talk about the kids, or let's talk about something that isn't about the divorce.
Right.
And this brings us into the question again of why I think love, marriage, and divorce is so morally interesting. First of all, we should say that love as a component of marriage is a relatively new thing in Western civilization. It's only about the last couple hundred years. I mean,
which is hard for people to understand.
Which is hard for people to understand, yeah. I mean, it had been a property relationship for a long, long time, and it was about the allegiance of families of property and or the transfer of property when women were viewed as property. Then in the 19th century, due to a variety of philosophers, also a variety of great writers, and most prominently probably Ibsen, the notion that women were kind of inherently treated as property in a marriage relationship was brought very much into the public, very much into public attention, and people started thinking about, insofar as marriage binds for life, it's a way of controlling women that is bound to be psychologically damaging to women. And then,
mm-hmm.
Of course, in the 20th century, we've seen how divorce has been, I think, instrumental to crucial to the entry of women into the workforce,
mm-hmm.
the emancipation of women, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So there's that moral dimension to it. The other one thing I'd like to quickly say is that for Aristotle, who didn't have the view of marriage we have today, he very much viewed marriage as just, you know, you had a wife. Aristotle did not, unlike most ancient Greeks, he was not a big fan of sex between men. He thought that sex should take place between men and women, but he also thought that a man and a wife were just there to provide kind of the social fabric of raising a family. However, he thought that the greatest moral force in life was friendship. And to me, this interestingly binds together the notion of love and marriage, because we all know that in the best of all possible marriages, the couple are also best friends. And for me, that is the goal, the moral goal of a successful divorce, is if you can preserve the friendship while recognizing that you're no longer going to be living together, sleeping together, raising the kids in the same house.
That's asking a whole lot.
Yeah, it is asking a whole
lot. As a matter of fact.
Yeah. But you did make this really important moral promise.
You know, Wayne, Clancy just presented this whole notion of the marriage vow as being this idea stocked with all kinds of ramifications, moral ramifications. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people in this country don't view it that way at all. It's a very simple deal. You made a promise. You stick to it. There's no moral implications here. You just do what you said you were going to do.
Right.
What do you say to that?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people who hold that view. You know, marriage as an institution is one of the oldest, one of the most central, and yet one of the most complicated social institutions that we have. It has personal moral ramifications. There are societal ramifications. There are legal ramifications. There are ethical or religious components to it. And where one fits and how one perceives a marriage will obviously have variation between what social group you belong to, what religious organization you might be affiliated with. You know, we see certainly in the headlines, certainly with sort of the Hollywood elite type, you know, they're in one marriage, they're out, in and out. And marriage seems to have probably a different social function, a different establishes one place in society in a certain way. In the way that I think marriage has in other cultures, it sort of established one's place and one's role in society, whom you can marry, whom you can't marry. And often, as Clancy said, that had really nothing to do with love. It had to do with any number of other important social components. And so what the ethical implications are for a person in that type of relationship, I think, is going to vary very much from someone who might have this sort of deep love interest and has made a personal commitment to another person as a different type of relationship. So I elicit emotion from you. I express love for you. I tell you that I'm going to be committed to you forever. I'm making a very direct personal promise to you in a certain way that I think has moral weight that is different than if I'm in an arranged marriage, that my parents and your parents got together, they put us and we find ourselves in this institution, which neither of us may be particularly happy with, which
right.
might lead us to a different type of institution. But that, you know, you're basically, are you as committed in a moral way to that type of marriage relationship? And I think not. And so I think one of the difficulties we have in American culture when it comes up to the issue of marriage and gay marriage and the various components of what marriage is we all bring a different expectation, a different understanding of what this relationship is about. And so we try to apply my understanding of what it means to be in a marriage, committed marriage relationship to you, who think, well, this is just a convenient way for us to be together. And, you know, we have kids and we're just going to be married until we're no longer happy with it, and we'll move on. And actually, you know, the idea of a starter marriage, have you heard this? You know, this is, you know, a marriage that's basically has no children. You're married for 2 or 3 years. You get divorced, very little property. It's kind of go your own way. It's called a starter marriage. And you just say, hey, okay, that was fun. Okay, now we go on to our second marriage, which might involve children and a more committed and more obligations. And so I think that the society has a wide variation in the sense of what marriage is about. And it's just very difficult to come in with one moral framework to say that this is right or this is wrong for any individual couple.
And so given all these different moral frameworks out there, Rebecca, how do folks sort of sort through all this? I mean, this gets very complicated very quickly. How have you sorted through it?
Well, just to speak to Wayne's last comment, I don't think that my clients who are young and haven't acquired a lot of property and don't have children would appreciate it if I told them that they were in a starter marriage.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yet it definitely is interesting. And often when, you know, clients, usually unless they've been divorced before, don't have a very clear understanding when they arrive at my office of what the divorce process entails. And from a legal position, you know, the courts really only care about you know, parenting plans and property settlements, mm-hmm. and all of the like bickering between the couples and the ups and downs of their relationship and their, you know, like what they view the marriage as being from a religious perspective or whatever is pretty much irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a lot of moral considerations like adultery and those sorts of things are even irrelevant to the court now. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't want to have – like you can – if a party has engaged in adultery or – I mean, that can speak to the credibility, right, of an adverse party. But not per se, you know. It's not about blaming someone or – but, yeah. you know, like in –
Which is a change in divorce in this culture in the past. Mm-hmm.
It is a change. But, you know, that sort of evidence can still be used to, if one party is behaving very badly during the divorce process. Judges aren't really fond of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just wondering, and this is obviously a very loaded question, Clancy, but I'm just wondering, you know, given the failure of so many marriages, you know, should we not put so much weight on it these days? I mean, are we making it more than it possibly can be?
Well, it's a great, great question.
Good
it's
luck. The, it's 30 the, seconds.
It's the, thanks. It's the central question of the last chapter of the book that I'm finishing now that I hope to turn in by the end of this month, is that very question, because I'm constantly confronted by other philosophers and other very sophisticated readers with precisely this view that is becoming more and more actually marriage is having resurgence in Europe right now. But previously, for about the past 20 years in Europe, people were having these long-term partnerships. And what is really the significant difference, especially if you're in enjoying all the benefits of the law that a long-term partnership has in most countries in Europe, what's the difference between that and a marriage? Can mm-hmm. I make any sense of that difference? And to me, at least in our present society, there is a different, an importantly different social role that one occupies when one is married than when one is in a long-term partnership. And there's a kind of shift in the perception of the relationship that that takes place with the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
There is a shift certainly in the perspective on the relationship legally. And I think because we are members of our society, there is a kind of shift in the perception of the relationship on the part of both people involved in the relationship. And part of that shift, it seems to me, involves a determination to get through tough times, no matter how tough those times may be, so long as both parties are willing to willing to try to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know I've been married.
It's a level of gravity, it's a level of seriousness.
Exactly, a level of earnestness and a kind of level of moral earnestness. That's exactly my point. I've been married twice now and failed twice. I'm hoping third time's the charm, I guess. But
the odds are against you.
Yeah,
right?
I know. The odds go downhill,
yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'll ever get married again. And I wish that the people in our audience could see the expressions on Wayne and Rebecca's face right now.
Everyone's giggling.
They're both laughing and skeptically. But in any event, to me, I feel like at least a year of family counseling almost ought to be required before anybody. In Texas, they have this 30-day or 60-day cooling down period. To me, that seems like not nearly enough. I think that there ought to be some sort of, at least, you know, you demonstrate that there's been 6 months of good faith family counseling or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe people would hesitate a little bit more before entering into such a contract, although I doubt it. I mean, when you're madly in love, you just want to get married, and it's as simple as that. Right.
Rebecca, chime in here.
I absolutely disagree with what Clancy is saying. I do think that, or what I often see in my own cases, is that you have one party who is misbehaving in the marriage and one party who maybe wants that marriage to work. And requiring people to go through 6 months or a year of counseling if the misbehaving party is already checked out just absolutely prolongs
mm-hmm.
the process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I always feel like, and this is what I will tell my clients too, is that you have no control over whether or not this person is going to change or put any real good faith effort into trying to work on the marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and particularly in cases which I see a lot of these, where one spouse is either emotionally or physically abusive. The other spouse needs certain protections and absolutely does not need to be going through some sort of long, prolonged counseling situation.
We're talking this morning about the ethics of love, marriage, and divorce. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. How do you regard the marriage vows? 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Wayne, before I go to some phone calls here, what about situations Rebecca's referring to where you have one member of a couple that wants out, the other member does not? What about those situations, which again strikes me as ethically and morally just perilous with all kinds of questions?
Well, I think it is. And as Rebecca's pointed out, the nuances of why one partner may want out of the relationship, why one wants to stay in, I think is especially relevant. And in cases of domestic violence, you certainly would not want to try to force a person to remain in a relationship, or
right,
try to work through what can actually be life-threatening for that particular person.
Well, we do remember, too, that a separation can be a physical separation. People could
right
be living apart, and a little bit of therapy probably never hurt anybody. But anyway, please
yeah
proceed.
But I think that you have to have two parties that would be willing, obviously committed in some ways to preserving the relationship in order for this to really have any, I think, meaningful long-term impact.
So you need both.
I think you would. And then the other question, the ethical question, is whether or not because you have engaged in a relationship, there might be some ethical obligation for you to try to put your best foot forward and trying to protect the relationship. And that very well may be the case, because each party made a commitment to this, and I think before walking away you would say, well, that you should have done that. But there are certain circumstances where I think that just is not possible, and someone's just sort of, okay, I'm done here, I can't do this for whatever reasons, and then the ethical obligation I think would be a little diminished.
So the question becomes, when does the importance of oneself exceed the importance given to the couple,
correct,
despite the marriage vow that has been made here, right?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And I think you would have to say marriages are designed, they should not only is there some mutual coming together, there are something in and of themselves, they should be there to enhance the individuals in and of themselves,
mm-hmm,
too. And if you have a marriage that's only taking away from one person and not giving anything meaningful back to that person, I think there's less of an obligation to remain committed to it.
Although stats will show you that, you know, marriages that sort of get through those rough patches tend to thrive long term.
Absolutely. I mean, marriage is a wonderful thing. Marriage is a very difficult thing. It's the trials and tribulations of marriage are offset by the rewards and happiness that come from it. And it's the people who think that I'm in love because everything's going well, and if things aren't going well, then I'm no longer in love, or this isn't worth maintaining, that you have a very shallow and superficial understanding both of human connectedness and relationships, but also of the institution of marriage.
And just quickly before I go to some phone calls, Clancy, the trend in society, and tell me if I'm wrong, for the last 40, 50 years has been that the needs of one's self have grown in importance compared to the need, I'm not sure I'm articulating this very well, the needs of a couple. It's one's own personal needs and desires that have sort of been elevated the way we look at marriage and divorce in recent decades. Am I right about that?
You're 100% right about that. And to me, I think that it's been very important that freedom has been very important for women. And I want to strongly support that that we had to make that transition away from, even though women 50 years ago were not legally property, in a lot of ways they were still sort of being treated as property. So that kind of freedom, I think, has been tremendously important for women.
They didn't work outside the home. They didn't have the freedom to
exactly
leave because they couldn't support themselves
right
financially. There's all
exactly
kinds of issues.
Exactly. Yeah. But today, one of the reasons why I think that trend is unfortunate is that well, I think the analogy with raising children is a good one. That is to say, imagine if your relationship with your children
were like your relationship with your spouse. And when your children were going through a really rough time, you just said, ah, the hell with these kids. Mm-hmm. You know what? I've had enough of them.
I've been there before. You're speaking my language here.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
It passes, but I've been there before.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. I've been there before a few times.
How many days a week?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now you're getting personal. No. Right?
And so I just think that we ought to view our marriages, especially when we have children, with the same kind of moral earnestness that we view our relationships with our children, and recognize that we're both growing. I mean, just because you're 44 years old in my case doesn't mean you don't still have a lot of growing up to do, just as my 17-year-old daughter has a lot of growing up to do, and my 7-year-old daughter and my 5-year-old mm-hmm. daughter. Mm-hmm. And I'm committed to that 17-year-old daughter no matter how naughty she gets, and she's going through a slightly naughty phase right now. She's still
at 17. Imagine that.
Right. Yeah.
Really briefly, Rebecca.
So, Clancy, are you suggesting then that the spouse should treat the misbehaving spouse like a child?
No, I'm not suggesting that, except insofar as I think that once you've made this family commitment, you there's more than one kind of love involved.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some phone calls, and let's go to Ken from Lee's Summit. Ken, good morning. You there, Ken? Let's go to Jeff from Lawrence. Jeff, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Thanks for calling, Jeff.
Welcome. Sure. So I just thought I would give my perspective from my own experience. I found out that my wife had an affair about a year ago. I found out about 2 months afterwards as I got a phone call from the other man's wife, which is pretty awkward. We had kind of worked through everything, gone to counseling, and things seem now to be better, really, than they ever have. My wife had a lot of kind of selfish tendencies before that she's really worked on and changed, and now really takes a active, is really active in the relationship. We have a young child, a toddler, mm-hmm. And it was kind of after her experience of giving birth and everything like that that I think is when things got really bad with her. I think she's kind of come around full circle and realized all the pain and how selfish she was before, and it's really made a huge difference.
Well, it says a lot that you stood by her through all of that, and I applaud that. And I'm glad that you guys came out happy on the other side, and congratulations.
Thank you. It definitely wasn't easy and still isn't always easy.
But Jeff, let me ask Jeff, why did you stay?
That is a good question. I don't know that I fully know myself. And then the easy answer would be something like, oh, I loved her, and I saw a better person inside. And while some of those things were true, there were also parts of me that, we had have a son, and I didn't really want to abandon the relationship because of him. Not that I'm staying with her because of him, but I also didn't want to break up the relationship if there was a chance it could work, because I'd like him to have a mom and a dad, just one of each. There were also, I didn't want to go through divorce for financial reasons or any number of reasons, even just potentially splitting up friends. I mean, there were so many, when I looked at it, there were so many reasons that things would change and not to split up. And the only reasons, I guess, to split up were kind of out of anger. She felt she wanted to still be in the relationship. She wanted to be a part of this, and I was willing to work on it and try to, I guess, quench my anger for a while to see if we could work through it.
Well, Jeff, listen, again, congratulations for sticking it out, and I wish you all the best.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks for the phone call. Bye-bye.
Yeah, enjoyed the program.
Thank you. Bye. Liz from Liberty. Liz, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's great to talk with you all. I find the topic very interesting. My only comment is that, yes, I am divorced. We were married for 15 years. took us 2 years after a separation to actually decide to get divorced. But the point I want to make is that in relation, especially to the other caller you just had, is that we made it very clear our children, and they were younger, 7 and 10, was that we were not divorcing the family. We were just splitting up with each other, and he would live in one place, and the children and I would live in our house. But we had a very, it was very amicable. We went to every school performance, every band performance, every football game, every baseball game. We went down to the University of New Orleans where my daughter was going to school in college. And apparently she told me, her friends were like, I thought you said your parents were divorced. And she said, well, they are. And they were like, because they were from houses that had been split up. And they're like, well, my parents don't act like that to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, you know, I think it's just instructive to families that may have to split up for whatever reason when you have children to make it clear to them, if you can get rid of your anger, that you're not divorcing the family, and that you can be compatible and compassionate with each other in the interest of your children.
Right. And Rebecca, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The cases that are the hardest for me and the other divorce attorneys that I talk to are when people use their children as pawns to try to get the other spouse to cooperate in one way or another.
Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the ethics or lack of ethics involved in love, marriage, and divorce. We'll turn to love and marriage and divorce itself in our second half. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversations yesterday with Afghanistan war correspondent Michael Hastings and with a daughter who read with her father every night until she left for college, you can find them at kcur.org. Tomorrow, presidential historian Robert Dalek. Today, we're talking about love, marriage, and divorce and the ethics of all those things with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both from UMKC, and Rebecca Martin, who's an attorney practicing in family law. If you want to join our conversation with your thoughts on all of this, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Clancy, when a couple falls in love, does that create certain moral obligations in your view?
It does create certain moral obligations in my view. Now, the falling in love process is an extremely interesting one because
yes, it is.
Yeah, as we've all, or the vast majority of us, have all fallen in love, and when you kind of sit back and try and take a look at how it's operating, you realize that it's this curious kind of participation between the both parties, which is not always also, which interestingly to me, not always an entirely truthful participation because you're sort of presenting yourself in one way.
They're the
presenting
best way.
In the best
yeah.
way, of course. Mm-hmm. They're presenting themselves in the best way. You're both being careful about what you're holding back because you're not
that's
wanting to give too
yeah,
much
right.
at once. And it's interesting because our ideal of love, and this goes all the way back to Plato, if not further, is that somehow love and perfect transparency and perfect truthfulness go hand in hand.
That's interesting.
Whereas, in fact, when you know you look at the way it actually operates, it isn't so much that way.
Well, at least in that phase of the relationship.
In that phase
right.
of the relationship, mm-hmm. in the falling in love phase of the relationship. I think you start moving more and more towards, hopefully, more and more towards transparency as your love matures and your friendship matures. But it's funny, you know, one time I was lecturing about this in St. Louis, and after talking about the relationship between love and truth and deception and promises and trust, and making an argument that maybe sometimes trust actually required a little bit of deception,
mm-hmm.
This woman who must have been in her late 70s, early 80s, raised her hand, and she said, "Well, if I understand you right, then what you're saying is that when people love one another, they probably are going to sometimes be obligated to lie to one another. And I said, yeah, that is one of the consequences of what I'm saying. And she said, well, my sister and I always only tell one another the truth. I mean, we just have complete transparency with one another. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. I said, well, how's your relationship with your sister? And she said, I hate that. And then I can't use the word on the radio of what she said.
And so much for transparency.
And everybody in the audience laughed. You know, there are about 200 people in the audience just roaring with laughter. And she realized that what she said was funny, but she was in dead earnest. And so I think the kind of moral obligation that the Buddhists have a notion about right action and right responsibility. And of course, you know, a marriage is not necessarily an institution that a real Buddhist is going to support. However, the idea about right action and right responsibility in this context, I think, would be always avoiding harm and preserving care. And I think a Buddhist approach to a marriage would be, how can we continue the relationship such that care for the other is always maximized? And that can be, I think, reconciled with divorce and
Well, Wayne, it's an interesting point that Clancy just makes there. If this whole idea of a beginning of any relationship is based on some element of deception, that seems to be a kind of a cautionary precursor to this whole notion of long-term relationships and what those are all about. Not a good warning sign there, I guess. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say. Not a good way, inauspicious beginning, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, I guess, you know, early relationships obviously involve some level of that. Everyone's on their best behavior. You kind of go out of the way to, you know,
I'm a nice
present
guy.
Yourself.
Yeah.
And it's not that you're not a nice person, but you typically are presenting a better picture of oneself than one is likely able to keep up on a long-term day-to-day situation. And that is a type of deceptive behavior, is to say, you know, when you're in the courting phase, you know, you want to do these types of things. But then, I mean, that can carry over. I mean, to what extent do you make – are you making up actual things, lying deliberately, or is it just kind of an appearance sort of thing that we all typically do? Now, the love issue, I think, is interesting because on one hand, I mean, you could think of it in terms of a biochemical response. On the other hand, you can think of it as this interpersonal relationship that one's developing. I think that we certainly understand human emotions and the range of human emotions and the impact of human emotion. And I think that when you are engaging in someone in a way that is deliberately trying to elicit a certain emotional response, you're taking an ethical responsibility for that person's the potential pain that's going to result from that. And so, you know, if I'm making overtures to someone, you know, sort of the typical taking advantage of someone or leading someone on, as they'll say, if you really are doing it for fun or for pleasure or whatever, and you're saying, oh, I love you, I want you to love me, and then it really is for one's own personal gain, whether it's sexual gratification or financial or whatever it might be, there I think you've gone into a territory that's clearly morally dubious. Because now you're deceiving the person for a for personal reasons of self-fulfillment that have nothing to do with respect for the individual for whom you know you're creating this emotional response, and you know who's going to suffer great harm from that. So I think that when engaging in any type of interpersonal social relationship, one has to recognize those characteristics of human nature and be sensitive to the fact that you can do something that causes another person great suffering and harm, and you can be morally culpable for that harm.
The ethics of love, marriage, and divorce is our topic here on Up to Date. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Brent from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to see adultery become illegal, not send someone off to prison for years or anything like that. But I'm a child of divorce, and when my father cheated on my mother, which they should have gotten a divorce, but not in the way that they went about doing it. And I know there were mitigating circumstances to why my father cheated, but he should have been strong-willed enough to go ahead, go through a divorce, and then it wouldn't, because it affects the kids, regardless of how it is tabled to you and explained to you, it feels like you're being cheated on as well. Because if one parent loses love for another, then what's that say to the child? It's like, oh my God, your love is that. You don't, as a child, you don't understand that. But the older I got, you know, I understood some of the feelings I had. It was like, well, I probably felt that if he could fall out of love with my mom that easily, why would that not be my brother and I as well?
Mm-hmm.
And the right wing, I'm not a right wing person at all. I if you want to go after protection of marriage, who cares about gay marriage? That has no effect on children, but adultery does. And there are, you know, I really think if I have children now, only reason I would ever get in a divorce from my wife is if infidelity, or if I thought the children were in danger, or myself.
Well, Brent,
outside of that, you just got to suck it up and tell your kids are out of the house.
Well, Brent, you would make adultery illegal. What kind of punishment would you attach to it?
You know, you could, if you want to make the person do community service for the next 5 years of their life every weekend, you know, something, you know, make it an inconvenience, make a fine, and maybe a fine that doesn't go to state, but maybe a fine that has to be put into a fund for your children's college. Or
Brent, let me get a response from Rebecca Martin here. What do you make of what Brent's saying?
Well, I think that if adultery was in fact illegal, that the court dockets would not be able to handle the number of cases that would be before it. And
more judges, more courtrooms, more everything.
Absolutely.
More expense.
I mean, adultery is just so pervasive in our society. I don't think that there's any real way that that could be prosecuted as a crime.
Hmm. Okay.
And there is, you know, a literature on this subject, and maybe the most famous book in the American tradition is called The Scarlet Letter. And remember the punishment that she had to suffer wearing this red A on her. I am sympathetic to – I do think that because of the kind of sexual, incredibly sexualized culture that we live in, we've become more tolerant of adultery perhaps than we ought to be. I always use this as an example when I'm teaching my students the difference between what's morally wrong and what's legally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Would you really want to go to jail if you kissed your best friend's girlfriend? We know that it's morally wrong for you to do that, but do you think you should go to jail on account of that? And maybe we shouldn't be too quick to throw people in prison.
Brent, thank you for the phone call. Kelly from Olathe. Kelly, you're on Up to Date with the ethics professors. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point that I've been married for 7 years, and both my husband and I come from very, I guess you could say, dysfunctional backgrounds. My dad's on his sixth marriage, and my husband's father's been married multiple times, and he actually is on his third stepmother. So we have lots of names for the nanas and grandmas. We're running out, actually. We're at our limit, and it's really confusing. I've actually had to number them for my friends, not for my husband's side, but for my side. My husband's family is fabulous. So, I mean, it's funny, but it's just so common. It's just the way it is. Now, his parents are awesome, and my family, they're wonderful people, but we've come from this completely weird background where we've never seen a healthy relationship, and we've been married 7 years, and we are now, just now, getting to the point where our relationship is healthy, where we're not showing signs of verbal and emotional abuse or manipulation, because that's what we're mimicking is what we saw.
Of course.
And we went through years of, both of us went to anger management, we went to marriage counseling, we went to individual therapy, and we did this because we looked at our kids. We're one of those couples that got pregnant on their honeymoon. And we looked at our kids and we were just like, okay, we're just going to do this because we are not going to put our kids through what we went through.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to do it. I think people get married really, really easily in this culture. It's way too easy to get married, way too easy to get divorced. And, you know, where you want to hit people, if you really want to punish people for their behavior, make it even more expensive to get married and more expensive to get divorced. I think people would, I don't know, if they had other options to try to figure out how they feel, if maybe therapy were more available and much more reasonable,
yeah.
I think people would be able to work through their problems better. But, and the other thing I really want to say real quick is that I have noticed, and I guess your ethics professors are going to see this, a huge uptick in the number of divorces I'm seeing because of Facebook. And I have three of my personal friends, I'm 30, and so everybody is like, at this. So many of our friends are getting divorced, and they've all been married about the same time. My mom says it's an age thing. And a lot of them, two of them, in fact, have been directly linked to adultery via Facebook from people they knew in middle school or high school sweethearts or something like that. So just be on the lookout. It's going to be an interesting topic coming up. Thanks.
Interesting phone call. Kelly, what do you make of Rebecca, what she's saying about making it tougher to get divorced, making it tougher to get married? Make sense?
Well, I think it's a lot tougher to get divorced than it is to get married. And one thing that I wanted to commend her for is taking the fact that she and her husband are mimicking dysfunctional relationships so seriously and not wanting their children to go through that. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's why divorce is a really important option, because if you have a couple that's in a marriage that's incredibly unhealthy, then you're modeling that to the children.
So there comes a point, you say, when it only makes sense.
Absolutely. And in the children's best interest, because you don't want your children to grow up and think that this was an acceptable relationship.
Yeah. Well, Wayne Vaught, but how do you then evaluate the ethical obligations that divorcing couples have when it comes to the well-being of their kids? That's just really a mouthful, right?
It absolutely is. And again, this will depend, I think, partly on the relationship itself and the stability of the environment for the children. And I think most of the callers would probably agree, and it sounds like one of the earlier callers agreed, that you're doing something for the children. You're making sure that they have a safe and stable environment, and you've brought them into the world. And I think that should be sort of a primary obligation that one has, and how one can make that happen is just absolutely critical. And then around that, I think that the couple would have an ethical obligation to each other. But and then again, it's also going to depend on the age of the children in terms of the nature of that responsibility. But when you have very young children, especially children who aren't capable or aren't self-sufficient in any sort of way, I think you have a greater sense of ethical obligation to protect yeah. them and provide a stable environment for them.
You know, it's interesting, Clancy. You sent me a link last night, I think, to one study, a 2002 study for the Institute for American Values in New York, found no evidence that divorce or separation typically makes adults happier than staying in an unhappy marriage. So what does that suggest? That it doesn't seem to offer much hope for unhappy married folks.
Well, what
you're not happy either way.
Yeah, what that particular study suggested, it's just one study, but that particular study does suggest that people in the end wind up being happier if they sort of stick it out through tough times and remain committed to their marriages. Now, there's so many different factors that can weigh into this, and whether certain people are predisposed towards sticking it out and they're perhaps predisposed towards being in long-term relationships and other people are not. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I do think that if there's one thing that seems to be kind of a common thread of our conversation, both from the callers and between the three of us, is that the recognition of the significance of the promise of the marriage vow, particularly once children are born into that marriage, is something that you almost can't take too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
That it, as you said in your opening remarks, is maybe the most important, or certainly one of the two or three most important promises that one will make in one's life.
Yeah, right. Let's get one more phone call here. Jennifer from the River Market. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, hi. My comment is really about the types of love that we're talking about. This whole fantasy world where people are falling in love and they're showing their best and, all of that we were commenting on earlier, that's the Eros love. It's the type of love the Greeks described as carnal, it's sexual, it's completely self-seeking. And, it's really the type of love that this modern day culture, especially in America, thrives off of. I mean, you know, your last caller was commenting on Facebook and how it seems to be interjecting in today's marriages and relationships, because we're in the day and age of self-publishing. Look at me, self-gratification. I want to be noticed. Love me for what I am. And this is what I am, you know, and look at all my photos and blah, 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 you know? And I think that...
Go quick, Jennifer.
Oh, well, and then agape love is the love of that is seeking out the highest good of others. And that's the one that we need to seek out of marriage and each other. It's going to be a better world if we do that.
Jennifer, thank you for the call. We're going to have to end on that very educational note. I want to thank our ethics professors for coming in. And
thanks,
Rebecca,
again.
Thanks for coming in today, too.
Absolutely.
All the best to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Our thanks to the ethics professors and Rebecca Martin for joining us today. You'll find guest bios, archives, and podcasts of our program. Everything is at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, one of the best presidential historians around, Robert Dalek. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.